Can you hear me? Yes, sir. Microphone's working. Thanks for the introduction. Hello, everybody. And I would like to thank, as many of us, the organizers, for not only putting together this wonderful conference with all these great speakers and these interesting talks, but also for taking so well care of coffee breaks, of receptions, of banquets. So I do enjoy it a lot being here, and thanks a lot for everything you have done here. I think it's highly appreciated. So I'm going to tell you about something that we have done over the last, let's say, 2 years or so in my group. That was together with my students, Achia Delfan, Erhan Zaglam-Jurek, postdoc Cecilia Lamela, well, myself, and which combines the idea of storage of quantum information with controlled state manipulation. So the motivation for that work actually arose out of, well, scenarios for quantum repeaters, and we have heard about those already twice, I think. Christoph Simon has introduced that 2 days ago. Nicole Hedges-Zern has spoken about that this morning. So this, one of the tasks is, or one of the things that you have to do, is to store the quantum state of a photon in a quantum memory here, and that photon may be entangled with another photon which went somewhere else, and do the same thing while close by. So this quantum state of the photon here would be entangled then with a photon which went over on the other side of the link. And if that actually happened, if we have entanglement between this quantum memory here and the quantum memory further on, and the quantum memory here and the quantum memory further on, well, then you read out the quantum memories and you apply some unitary transformation and some detections, some measurements of photons, which then would hopefully correspond to the projection onto one of the four Bell states. While we know with linear optics it's not all possible, let's just assume for the moment we have some way to do that. So what we have here is, in a way, two different unitary transformations. The one is the simplest one we can think of, and still, the experimentalists, we struggle a lot with this, so we want to have, well, this one, this unity operation for a very long time. And this one here is a little bit more complex. And the question is right now, okay, can we combine these two unitary operations? Do we gain anything from combining these two? And I think we do, and that's the motivation of that talk, and we'll tell you more in the next 35 minutes. I want to point out that there is this unitary operation here would work on both qubits, so that would correspond to a joint measurement at the end here. That one I will come back in my discussion. What we mostly deal with right now, what this talk will deal with, is the unitary operation just on one single quantum system, which is easier to implement than the other one. So here's the outline of the talk. I will remind you of one particular approach to quantum memory, which is a photon echo type approach. We have heard more about those from Nicolas Gisant this morning. I will introduce it a little bit differently. So the one I will introduce is the script-based approach, controlled, reversible, inhomogeneous broadening. I then will tell you how you can actually extend the idea of storage, so of doing nothing for a long time, to doing something in addition to nothing for a long time. So that would be beyond storage. And we'll then go to a protocol which does not allow us to store single photons. It needs strong pulses of light, many photons encoded in the same state. So that would be a traditional three-pulse photon echo. So it's not as powerful as a single photon, but it shares many, many things with the standard quantum memory protocol. And the big advantage of that one is that it's relatively easy to implement in the lab, and we can learn a lot from that. So that would be a test bed for a protocol which I believe can, in principle, then be done later on using a true quantum state storage approach. And the example that I will give you, the thing that we have done in the lab, is actually the unambiguous discrimination of states. I will mostly talk about qubits here, but we can also cue for qutrits and for more complicated systems. And I will finish with the discussion and re-put the whole thing in context with storage of single photons and what we can maybe do in the context of true quantum information processing. So let's imagine we have an ensemble of atoms, an atomic vapor, or maybe rare earth ions doped into a crystal, and the rare earth ions would be cooled down to low temperature. So what you have then is an ensemble where each atom absorbs at a different frequency, and we assume that the homogeneous line width, meaning the resonance line width of each individual atom, is very small, but that the whole ensemble features an inhomogeneously broadened line width. So each atom absorbs at a different frequency, that may be Doppler broadening in the vapor, that may be the fact that you replace a small ion, which is part of a crystalline lattice, by a much larger rare earth ion, and that creates defaults and strain in the crystal, so that also leads to inhomogeneous broadening. So let's assume we have that, and now we shine our quantum state of light into this ensemble, and we assume that the optical depth is such that we absorb the incoming light for sure. That can certainly be done, at least to a very, very good approximation. What happens then is that the electric field, well, the photon, the state of the photon, will decay as a function of Z and T. And, well, that gives rise, or is due to, the creation of forward-propagating coherence, which depends on ZT and the detuning of each particular atom as compared to the carrier frequency of light, so that's in the rotating frame. And I have to integrate over the inhomogeneous broadening with some weighting function g here. So that describes how the electric field changes as a function of position z and time t. So that's Maxwell's equation. And we also have to look how the forward propagating coherence changes as a function of time. So that is the second equation here. That's part of one of the block equations. So actually two block equations together, one for u and v. We don't have to care in this approach, or we don't consider in this approach, the change of the inversion, because we assume that the photon, well, we absorb one single photon, let's say, in a macroscopic number of atoms. So the inversion will certainly always be minus one. So we don't care about the third equation. So these two equations here, one for the electric field, one for the forward propagating coherence, tell us what happens upon absorption, and you realize the coherence well changes as a function of detuning with respect to the carrier frequency and changes as a function of the electric field. Yeah? We have ignored all decay due to radiative and dipole decay. So that's kind of a somewhat idealized assumption. So what we would like to do right now in perfect quantum state storage is simply time reverse the absorption process. So if we send light into one direction in the medium, we should do something to this medium, and light should come back out in the inverse direction. So what we have to do is look, instead of looking at this set of equations that tell us how the forward propagating electric field and the forward propagating pseudo spin wave changes as a function of t and z, we have to look at the backward propagating ones, which we do by adding a minus to these equations here. So right now that set of equations describes what happens for light propagating in backwards direction. So of course, in order to do that, we have to map the excited coherence on the forward in forward propagating mode, which was excited based on the wave traveling in forward direction. We have to map that one on coherence for the backward propagating mode so that that can later on stimulate the emission of light in backward direction. So this is done using a phase matching operation or mode matching operation. And one way to do that is to map the coherence between state 1 and 3 onto state 1 and 2 and back using two counter-propagating pi pulses. So that will become important on the next slide again, to keep these two pi pulses here in mind. The next thing we do is that we reverse the detuning for all atoms from delta to minus delta. We heard that one from Nicola as well. So what that means for the second set of equations is that we change the minus sign here to plus sign here. And then at the end, we also consider the light field with a global phase of pi, which doesn't make any difference since it's a global phase. So by doing that, we add a minus one here, and we also flip the sign here. So now if I compare these two equations with these two equations, I see that they are exactly the same if I also change the derivative with respect to t. So instead of having a plus there, I get a minus, which does not arrive here for some reason. Okay, so if I change the derivative with respect to t, well, I get a minus here, which means on the left-hand side of the equation, I haven't done anything. The right-hand side doesn't change at all because I integrate over all detuning, so that one is constant. And if I look at that equation, well, I've changed the left-hand side now. I've changed this one, so everything has seen a change of sign here. So what it means is the equations of motion that describe backwards evolution of our atom light system describe a time-reverse evolution as compared to the equations of motion that describe forward evolution during absorption. Okay? And the fact right now that we can couple the boundary conditions after the forward evolution, after absorption, and before backward evolution by enforcing this mapping of excited coherence and by knowing that the electric field is down to zero, that ensures that at the end, whatever happens to our light atom system, it will happen exactly time-reversed, so that at the end of the whole process, all atoms are back in the ground state where we started, and the photon is emitted for sure. So this is actually a very nice and very simple way to prove perfect time reversal. This is a very simple way to prove perfect quantum memory. You do not have to solve any Schrödinger equation, do anything complicated. You just have to look at a hidden symmetry which is hidden in the Maxwell block equation. So this is actually a proof which goes back to Barbara Krauss, which she did at the time when I still was in Nicolas Gisant's lab. And at the same time, similar ideas have been put forward by Matthias Nielsen and Stefan Kröll, and also by Annabel Alexander from the Australian group, Michael, Matthias and Stefan, they are in Lund. This is the group in Canberra, which has done a lot of things there. Just want to point out that there is a different way of doing photon echo quantum memory, that is the atomic frequency comms that Nicola has mentioned this morning, and under certain constellations, you can actually show that both can be described, both approaches to quantum memory can be described using a combined, a joint mathematical framework. So let's expand a little bit on this idea and go beyond simple storage. Yeah? So I recall that at some point we have these two pi pulses which map coherence between state 1 and 3 onto coherence between state 1 and 2 and back. Yeah? What has been shown in 2004 by Sergei Moiseev is that if we replace this readout pulse, meaning this pi pulse here, by a sequence of pulses, let's say two pulses, one with an area which is smaller than pi, which then recalls coherence only partially, which then gives rise to emission of the photon with a certain probability amplitude, which is not unity, and then recall the rest using a pi pulse, then a photon which comes in one temporal mode would come out of our memory in a superposition, in a coherent superposition of two temporal modes. So what we have here resembles very much a standard beam splitter, only that here our unity on our interaction acts on temporal modes, while a standard beam splitter acts on spatial modes. But the rest is similar. So that gave rise to the idea, okay, how far can we actually go with analogon? Can we use something like that? Can we implement something in the lab? And the important thing you have to realize, and that is a result which is due to Michael Reck and Anton Zeilinger and two others back in 1994, which says that any discrete unitary operator can be realized with beam splitters and phase shifters. Well, here we have our beam splitter and we have our phase shifter. So how far can we use this idea? How far can we spin this idea? And can we actually use it in order to implement, well, maybe not any unitary transformation, but maybe some of them. So experimentally, photon echo quantum memory is still very challenging. It has been done right now. There's lots of great results. We have 66% storage in a group in Canberra. In Geneva, we have AFC and CRIB and also the mapping on ground state coherence. In Orsay, there have also been experiments which were good, and Lund have also done work there. So there is a lot of things happening right now. And if you combine the different results and gloss over the fact that these are all different crystals, you really get something which is really powerful. Well, we still have to combine all these different things, but I think it's really moving fast in the right direction. But anyway, it is still tricky to do. What is much simpler is to use something which is known since 1982, or maybe even longer, which is the stimulated photon echo. Well, it is very similar, and I will come back to that in the next two slides, and it is much, much simpler to implement in the lab. The problem of this approach is the efficiency is very small if you want to make sure that the fidelity of your recall state with the input state is large, what we need. But still, it can serve as a test bed for photon echo-based storage and manipulation. So this whole idea goes back to 1963 and 1964, where independently Kopp-Willem and Najibarov and Konit, Abella and Hartmann proposed a photon echo type, well, a photon echo. So that was itself, Jill, that itself was initiated by Hans spin echo, which was discovered before. So here as well, we have an inhomogeneously broadened medium. So here we look right now at the Bloch sphere that describes, the state of our ensemble of atoms, and we send in the first pi over 2 pulse. So we assume that all atoms are initially in the ground state. This is an optical transition, so there is no thermally excited population in the excited state here. So the first pi over 2 pulse brings the Bloch vector to the equator, and now we look at everything in the equatorial plane, and we assume that the first pi over 2 pulse made a rotation around the axis V, so right now everything points into the plus U direction. Now, given that that our ensemble is inhomogeneously broadened, while atoms with different resonance frequency will pick up phase, the phase that determines the superposition between ground and excited state, pick up this phase at different rates. So what we get is dephasing. Our macroscopic Bloch vector pointing in that direction will dephase. Some atoms move into this direction, some atoms Bloch vector moves clockwise and some counterclockwise. So we get dephasing. The question is right now, can we undo dephasing? And this dephasing is exactly the same thing which happens in the standard quantum memory type approach. In this approach here, dephasing is undone not by reversing the inhomogeneous broadening, because that requires more control on the atom than at that time people knew was possible. But you can do it by sending in a pi pulse, which also makes a rotation around V. And after that, we flip all these individual block vectors around this axis here, so they start, they just lie on the opposite side of the sphere. And the phase evolution is still the same, so right now, instead of dephasing, we get rephasing. And you see that then the same time later, or the same time as the time here, this time later, all individual dipole moments will superpose coherently and give rise to the emission of a pulse of light, which is called an echo pulse. Yeah, so this is the standard photon echo, and that one is known for quite a long time. And then in 1979 and 82, again, independently, Russian researchers, Eluten, Zakharov, and Mendekind, probably pronounced it wrongly, and also Thomas Mossberg from the United States, proposed how you can actually extend that idea to storage of data. Yeah, so here, this is the original scheme, a pi over 2 pulse, a pi pulse, and the echo comes out. Now let's split the pi over 2 pulse into two, sorry, the pi pulse into two pi over 2 pulses, and let's even separate them in time. So it turns out that even then, well, we still get an echo out. And now you can think of that like, well, the full transformation of this double pulse, if I assume for simplicity right now, two delta pulses, is a sinus where the spacing between two maxima is 2 pi over the duration between these two pulses. Yeah? So what it actually means is that the atoms are irradiated by light with this spectrum, which then gives rise to atoms, depending on their frequency, which are in the ground state, if there was no light at the frequency, or are excited with a certain probability if they would absorb that frequency component here. So what we actually do here is to register the Fourier transformation of this data pulse sequence as an absorption grating in the atoms. And then after that, we send another pulse of light in. This light will see a medium whose absorption is frequency dependent, will thereby take on a similar Fourier spectrum here, and that means that whatever comes out cannot be one single pulse, but must be two pulses, and the second one is the echo. Sorry, is the echo here. Now, you can extend that, and you see very, very easily what happens. Well, if I don't use one single pulse here, but a sequence of pulses, well, the Fourier transformation of these three certainly reflects, well, these three. And now, if I send in this data pulse, well, this read pulse here, well, what comes out are the remaining pulses. Yeah? So you see directly where how we come to a storage of classical pulses in this type of setup. And here are just some results. I think the record is storage of 1760 bits in one single spatial location by having one write pulse, this whole sequence of read pulses, sorry, data pulses, and then one read pulse who reads all that out. What you see here is an experiment that was done in Stefan Kroll's group where they actually stored 330 bits. And what you see here is the recall bit, and you see very well that 0 and 1s are easily distinguishable. So that's, of course, interesting, but we want to go beyond. And one of the features in quantum information or quantum physics in general is, of course, the fact that we can have superposition, that we can have interference. And many of the Euler transformations that I talked about in my first slide are actually done using optical interferometers. Yeah? And we have heard this morning from Nicolas a first approach to that. So that was sending in a pulse of light through an interferometer, which then creates two pulses. And what I have here right now is the optical analogon to what I'm going to talk about later, because you're much more used, or many people, including myself, are much more used to that one. I always find it much simpler to drive or to use this analogon here. So we create from one pulse of light, we create two, and we think of that as this one having been constituted of many individual photons, each one in the superposition of being here or here. It could be timing qubit. And then to analyze it, we send this again through an interferometer with the same path length difference, so either our photon goes straight through or is delayed, and if both are opened, it goes both straight through and is delayed, and what we get then is interference and superposition in the central time window here, and then depending on the phase in this measurement interferometer and the phase of whatever was encoded initially, well, we get constructive or destructive interference. So what we have here is actually a von Neumann measurement, a projection measurement on the two-dimensional Hilbert space, well, in this temporal window, in the two-dimensional Hilbert space, which is originally used in order to encode this qubit here. So how do we do this with photon echoes? Well, we send in a write pulse and two data pulses. So that would mimic what was created here by this interferometer. Then if we read it out once, well, we get this echo, which resembles the data pulse, only much weaker. If we read it out instead of the first readout a little bit earlier or later, well, we get the same thing, only everything is displaced in time. Now, if the readout pulses are sufficiently weak, so that a lot of this population grating, what I have initially created by having this interaction between these three pulses and my atomic medium, that a lot of this grating is still persistent, well, I get two echoes out, and again, I get superposition and interference of echoes in the middle time window. And then again, if I change the phase between read pulses or data pulses, well, I see the sinusoidal variation, or you can see perfect constructive interference here, or close to perfect destructive interference here. And if we do this by changing the phase in small steps, while we see the sinusoidal changes of count rates or intensities observed as one expects from a standard optical experiment. And then if I change the phase in the data pulse, well, we see that everything is displayed as expected, as it would be in a standard optical setup. So that was done back in 2006, again, Nicolas' group, when I was still there. And we want to go a little beyond that right now. And we want to show something which is a little bit more complicated and want to see a little bit, okay, how far can we go? What are really advantages and drawbacks with this method? And what we saw already before is that the stability and the quality of these measurements was really, really good. The visibility is very, very close to one, which in an optical setup is very difficult to achieve. So that gives promise, that gives hope for doing something more complicated. And the more complicated thing that we want to do is to go beyond Fanon measurements. Yeah? So you know, well, Fanon measurements allow you to make projections onto orthogonal subspaces, horizontal, vertical, a photon arriving here or here. But it is possible in principle to do also projection measurements on non-orthogonal states, obviously not always successful. Yeah. So if you do that, there must be also the possibility that sometimes you cannot identify your quantum state, and that is built in quantum mechanics, and these things actually give rise to the security of quantum cryptography. And obviously for the fundamental understanding of quantum information science, it's a very important thing to see, okay, how good can you actually identify states? Can you always, well, it turns out there's two possibilities. Either you always have a result, but sometimes it's wrong, or you do not always have a result, but if you get one, you know exactly what quantum state was there. So these things have been investigated starting in 1987 and 8 by Ivanovich, Deeks, and Paris. Then there was more work by Stephen Bartlett, who's somewhere here, I think, and others. So there's been quite a lot of theoretical work. There have also been a couple of experiments, and we want to follow this path. So for timing qubits, the setup to identify two different qubit states, which are written here with computational states 0 and 1, so that would be photon in an early time interval or in a late time interval, well, you see that these two states are clearly non-orthogonal. The inner product is not 0. Yeah. Let's assume right now that the task is to identify one or the other, and the two are given to us randomly distributed with the same probability. So the first thing we do is that we send this state, which is depicted here, onto a very fast switch, which is synchronized with the arrival time of these different wave packets, such that the early arriving wave packet will be sent to the delay arm here, and the later arriving wave packet will be sent to the shorter arm here. So what we get is a mapping of that state to this state here. So what we have done is actually we have simply exchanged 0 and 1, which label time bin qubit basis states, with A and B, which right now label spatial modes. The next thing we do is that we act with loss on whatever is in mode B, or rather we couple mode B partially into mode C. So that is done here right now. And you see if you choose the loss or the coupling ratio correctly, that is the state which emerges. Now let's imagine we do not find a photon in mode C prime here, which then means that we have to look at the subspace which is described by modes A and B. So if I look at the subspace, I see that whatever remains from this, so 1 over square root of 3, A plus or minus B, these two states become orthogonal. So right now I can make a standard von Neumann projection measurement and can conclusively identify is it one state or the other one. Yeah? To summarize that, what we can do with this setup is send in this quantum state. We have to know what are the two states we have to identify. If we get a detection in mode C prime, well, we know that we cannot identify the state, so we don't know anything. If we get a detection in mode A, well, this corresponds unambiguously, or we know unambiguously that the input state was the state psi plus. And if we get a detection in mode B prime, we know unambiguously that the input state was psi minus. So this is how you would do it with an optical setup. And of course, as I said, you cannot always identify or always distinguish between the states, but the fraction is given by 1 minus the overlap between the two states here, and this is what is now called the Ivanovich-Deeks-Paris limit. In real, we would not use this optical switch because optical switches are difficult to synchronize and are lossy, so we can achieve the same thing by just having a standard beam splitter, and then instead of sending the early pulse to the delay line and the late pulse here, while both wave packets evolve to both arms, so what we get at the output is not just one possible detection time, but three of them. But if you look at the central time temporal window, then we get exactly what I have explained to you before using the other slide. So what we still need right now is to identify how, given a matrix that you want to do, that you want to implement, how do we implement with photon echoes? How do we do this step? In those examples before, it was rather simple, but if you get something more complicated, you need something which is a little bit more structured, something that really gives you a recipe to this. And the first thing we realize is that if we work with sufficiently weak pulses, and for simplicity right now, we assume that all these pulses are short, are delta pulses, that then the electric field in the echo, which would correspond to the probability amplitude of a particular quantum state, remember an echo arising at time t would correspond to one of my basis vectors for my qubit, or qutrit. This one is linear in the electric field of the data pulse and in the electric field of the weak pulse. Why is that important? Well, if we look at the state that we would get after some matrix acts on our input state alpha beta, so alpha would be the probability amplitude associated with a particular particular data pulse arising at a particular time, beta is the probability amplitude associated with the data pulse at a different time. So if we have some matrix acting on that, this gives this new vector here. So that tells us that we have to read out the data pulse which encodes probability amplitude alpha with a photon echo whose electric field is given by this complex number here, so we have some magnitude and we have some phase, and we have to superpose that date, this photon echo, with a photon echo that arises from the data pulse beta and which is read out with a read pulse which has this electric field magnitude. So that would be the first new basis vector, that would be a photon echo arriving at a particular time. Now, the second basis vector would be given by this one, and then if you have a more complicated transformation, we just go along with this. Yeah? So the important thing is that the echo here is linear in data and read pulse electric fields, and that obviously this multiplication here, these are all linear things. So if you do that, what you get instead of this optical setup, you get a series of readout pulses. So there are two readout pulses which then correspond, if you look at the central mode here, which correspond to the output number 1, then you repeat your sequence of readout pulses just with a different phase. Here's a phase change of pi, here's no phase change between these two, and that corresponds then to the second output, and then at the end, well, you read out once more, and then whatever you find in this time window here, and the laser pointer is not working very well, I hope you can still see it, this corresponds then to the projection or to the detection in the third output here. So that's really a one-to-one mapping between a photon echo and an optical setup. So the experimental setup, well, we work with erbium lithium niobate, and in addition to having erbium in the lithium niobate, we also have a waveguide in the lithium niobate. So that makes coupling with fibers relatively easy and is promising for future implementation in networks, and also has advantages if you have to apply electric fields, which is not done in this setup right now. So the data pulses that we create start with a CW laser at 1532 nanometer wavelength. So this is actually the transition between the 4i15½ and 4i13½ multiplex, and what we use is the lowest line Stark levels in those, so then we have a zero phonon line. So we work at that wavelength here. Then we intensity and phase modulate the CW laser so that at the end we get pulses out. We amplify everything, in an erbium-doped fiber amplifier, so that is the nice thing about working at telecom wavelengths, you have all these things handy. There's another intensity modulator here which simply makes sure that the amplified spontaneous emission that is always exiting the fiber amplifier does not heat up the waveguide, doesn't heat up the cryostat, or burn spectral holes in this material here. And then we have a sequence of pulses which enter the waveguide. The pulse length is 15 nanoseconds. The peak intensities or peak powers are 5 milliwatt for the read pulse and 1 milliwatt for the data, for the write pulse and 1 milliwatt for the data and read pulses. So the coherence time we get at 3 Kelvin and 0.4 Tesla is roughly 80 microseconds, which is by far long enough for anything you want to do. And at the end, we look at the signal with a fast photodiode and look at the oscilloscope. Yeah. That is the setup. What you see here is this erbium-doped lithium niobate waveguide under red light illumination. So you see here the waveguide shining. So the whole thing is then in the cryostat. We couple fibers from here and from here against the waveguide and apply a magnetic field in the direction in order to increase the coherence time. So here what you see here and here is the superconducting coil we use for that. Here are the experimental results. So this is just a reminder of the sequence that we need. So we send in a first write pulse, two data pulses, and then we have these three sequences of recall pulses. And what you see here is the recall pulses measured before the cryostat, before the sample. And what you see in red is what we get out after the cryostat. So that includes the response of the sample. And what you see is the sequence of pulses here, here, and here. So what that actually is exactly what we expect from the optical setup. And the only thing which is different is this decrease here, which is the detector response. So this is not due to light. This is directly what happens with the detector. And you see, for instance, if we send in the Psi plus state, that then we have a very large probability of detecting something in this central time window here. Basically, no probability of detecting anything in this middle time window here. And then there is some probability of detecting something in what is the inconclusive event. So that clearly shows us that we can identify the plus state. We find a detection here, but none here. If we send in the minus state, well, we find basically nothing in this time window, a lot in this time window here, and we still have the inconclusive results. Now, we repeated this measurement for many different input states, all of the form cosinus alpha 0 plus or minus sinus alpha and 1. It's not the most general one. We didn't change the phase between these two, but it already covers a large set of possible states. And what we have plotted here, the black dots here, is the error rate when doing an unambiguous state discrimination, when doing a generalized measurement. So you see it's always around, let's say, 2% or so. Theoretically, it should be zero. Well, that's real life, so it's a little bit larger. So that is what you would expect, or what you do expect, from this unambiguous state discrimination. If you do the standard von Neumann measurement, where you always get a result, but sometimes it's wrong, well, then the error rate is given by these red dots here. So we see that sending in the state where actually the two states to identify are orthogonal, these error rates are very closely the same, which should be the case. And then as soon as you move away from having two orthogonal states, the error rate in the von Neumann measurement increases and is always larger than the error rate in an ambiguous state discrimination measurement. Okay, so let me discuss this and give you a short outlook for the future. So what I've shown you is storage and data manipulation using a photon echo type atom light interaction. In this case, it was a classical traditional photon echo which does not allow us to store single photons, but I've shown that you here, you can learn a lot from that and you can really learn a lot of things that you can actually do. We believe that there is a way to generalize that also to quantum state, to true quantum state storage protocols, and that then opens quite a lot of possibilities in quantum information processing. The examples I've given was unambiguous state discrimination for qubits, and it turns out that you can easily also do it with qutrits. And I don't want to go into any detail here. What I show here is an optical setup which was realized in the group of Ephraim Steinberg. So what you see here is 8 interleaved interferometers which have to be phase stabilized. So that becomes very easily a very complicated and difficult to control setup, and that's not even a complicated measurement. For photon echo approach, it simply means that the readout sequence has two times three pulses instead of two times two, and one times two instead of one times one. So it's very easy to go from one setup to the other one. Changing your interferometer, rebuilding your interferometer means you have to reprogram your function generator, which may take a minute or maybe 10, but it's a very, very simple thing. So that is kind of what you see here, and I don't go into detail on the right-hand side, is the outcome of that measurement. But what I want to show you here is that it's indeed very simple to go from one setup to the other one, and I think you can do very complicated setups. So the open questions that remain right now, well, can we use these kind of approaches for multipath interferometric precision measurements? Monitor very rapidly changing index of refraction changes in an explosion, for instance. Yeah, it could be possible. How good it gets, I don't know. I haven't looked into it in detail, but it's promising. That may actually already work using the traditional, not efficient approach, the one that we have pursued here. The other one is, well, there's a lot of implementations of joint measurements that you can do using linear optics. Actually, you can do all of them. It's not as efficient as if you use true CNOT gates, for instance. But you can do a lot, and there's Neil Laflamme and Milburn have shown us how to do it. And the question which is open right now is, okay, can you build your linear quantum computer or some information processor, quantum information processor, using that kind of approach with this huge possibility where you can easily change the setup and program a different type of unitary operation, and where the stability is given by the stability of your function generator, which is much easier to control than the stability of your interferometer. I think it's a very interesting thought. I don't know the answer, but it's for sure worth pursuing further. So I thank you for your attention. I thank the sponsors and the three people who were involved in this. It's Cecilia Lamela, Achdiel Delfan, and Erhang Samdeniwak.